welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. President Trump held his first campaign rally of 2020 last week in Toledo. He told the crowd that Ohio just had the best year economically in the state's history. That runs contrary to employment data that shows Ohio actually lost jobs last year. It's the first time that's happened, as a matter of fact, in a decade. We're talking about the road to 2020 and more on our weekly reporter roundtable. Jackie Borchardt is the Columbus Bureau Chief for the Cincinnati Enquirer. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Marty Schladen is a reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back.
Hi, Ann.
All right. Did either of you go to the Trump rally in Toledo?
I did not.
I did not, but I watched it on TV from my home.
And what did you make of the speech? It was pretty standard Trump, right?
Yeah. You know, he spoke for about an hour and a half. You know, there was quite a bit of there's some news out of it. A lot of the rallies, his campaign rallies, you kind of have like kind of the greatest hits, things that you can hear pretty much at every rally. But this one, he did have, you know, the events in Iran to also bring up and rally around. And I think that kind of was the news of him, again, expanding on that and on, you know, foreign policy.
I was surprised that there never appeared to be any question that he would be appearing in Toledo. And that surprised me that there wasn't a moment along the line that someone said, well, it might fall through because of Iran.
Yeah, I guess maybe it would have been different, I would have been hearing that kind of criticism because I haven't heard that, but maybe that criticism would have been louder had it been like the next day or maybe 2 days later.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not over. I mean, we're still, you know, there were protests over the weekend, the whole, you know, the issue with the plane. It's carrying into now another week of leading the news cycle.
Why call off a pep rally just because of that?
And he's having another one, I believe, in where is he going to be next? Wisconsin?
I don't know.
One thing I think was interesting about the rally, I was telling Jackie before the show, is when he started to talk about an attack on an embassy in Baghdad, I believe, during the rally in Toledo. And then the next morning he went on Fox News and said that there were Iranian plans to attack four other embassies. And none of the members of Congress who've been briefed have been told that. His senior officials of administration went on the Sunday talk shows yesterday and said they hadn't seen that. And I wonder whether this is, the River Rubicon in his administration. There are a lot of people saying it's one thing to, you know, say things that aren't true about the job market in Ohio. But when you're saying things that may very well launch a major war and you're refusing to show any evidence to back it up and you're this president with these kinds of questions about your credibility, I wonder if this isn't a lasting problem for him.
You mean that it actually breaks through the base resistance?
Maybe not the base, but people more around the fringes, people in Congress, in his own party. Several came out of the briefing, like Mike Lee of Utah, and said, this is the worst briefing I've ever seen. I just think that this is where it gets real. When you're potentially putting troops in harm's way, starting a conflict where you just never know where you're going to end up, particularly in the Middle East, there's probably a little bit more, a higher standard for truth telling, especially after what we went through in the early 2000s.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Marty Schladen of the Columbus Dispatch. Also with us, Jackie Borchardt of the Cincinnati Enquirer. So do you think there is a River Rubicon that can be crossed at this point with Donald Trump, Jackie Borchardt?
I don't know. I think every time I think there is one, it turns out not to be. Uh-huh. You know, we're really into an election cycle here now. And so I don't know if that will calculate into decisions that are made in the administration. I was listening to your fine station this morning, and they had interviewed a Canadian opinion writer who, you know, his take on this was that everything that was going on in Iran was a distraction to try to get away from impeachment that was driving the news. And we've seen you know, instances of this over his term where, you know, he'll do something or tweet something to, and it does kind of move the news in a different direction, in the direction that he would prefer. So I don't know if this is that, or if this continues to grow into the River Rubicon and actually make a difference.
A few other things that are going on as all this stuff happens. You know, we've got all these protests in Iran now over the downing of the airliner.
Not the downing of the airplane. Protests over how the government of Iran responded.
Exactly.
Saying at first denying any culpability and then coming out later and admitting that there had been a misfire.
People there were already pretty fed up. They had really big protests several weeks ago before Soleimani was assassinated. Then they went to the streets to protest that in solidarity with their government. But now they're back out protesting their government. And at the same time, we've got at least a very strong element in Iraq telling us they want our troops to go home. And the posture of the administration right now is no. And I wonder how that works for Donald Trump on the campaign trail over time among his base.
Huh. Michael Bloomberg was in Akron on Wednesday. How is another, well, I'm not even sure Trump's a billionaire, but because we haven't really seen his tax records yet, but Michael Bloomberg is undeniably extremely successful billionaire. He was in Akron on Wednesday. He was talking about job creation as well. How do you see Ohioans, I guess Democratic voters in particular, responding to the likes of Michael Bloomberg?
Well, I got to meet him when he went to Chillicothe a few weeks ago, and then he came up to Columbus for a fundraiser. He's not the most charismatic politician. He's not sort of the guy you're going to sit down and have a beer with or talk about your feelings. But there's a column in the Washington Post yesterday or today, some political expert saying that Bloomberg's got a strategy to be the last man standing in the Democratic field. He's deploying all sorts of resources here and in California and all these Super Tuesday states. And he, according to this gentleman, Bloomberg has plans to spend possibly more than $1 billion of his own money. So he is going to go up with maybe five times the ads that Donald Trump does on television. Mm. There's at least this analyst thinks that Bloomberg's got a legitimate shot of using his own resources and, you know, spending his way into an election as or a nomination as the Democratic candidate.
What do you think, Jackie Borchardt?
Well, yeah, I mean, it is kind of fascinating to watch what happens when you have like a blank check to run your campaign. You know, so far in Ohio, the Elizabeth Warren campaign has a couple of staffers here and field office, handful of field offices. But Bloomberg came in and has a dozen field offices, hired more than 50 people in the state. He's hired hundreds of people across the country. It's just by sheer size of staff and, you know, I think I read somewhere $200 million in ads so far that he's spent. I mean, it's like unbelievable. I don't know. You look at the other campaigns, it's just such a completely different operation. So I think as someone who, you know, watches and pays attention to politics, that's fascinating to me to see how mm-hmm. this is kind of starting up so fast. And it's a different strategy than we're used to. You know, we're used to seeing people spend a lot of time in Iowa and New Hampshire and Nevada and South Carolina. And looking to those states is kind of the, you know, to take the temperature of the field. And Bloomberg's strategy just doesn't even go there. His is a very different game.
When I met him, the first question I asked him is whether he found it disturbing that he is a billionaire, has a path to the presidency that the vast, vast majority of Americans don't have. And he disagreed with the premise of the question. But I anticipate that as this goes on, he's going to be asked about it more.
Why did he disagree with the premise of the question?
He basically said that everybody has, you know, different advantages. We all bring something different to the party. But, you know, I wasn't convinced by that.
I think we should also mention he does have executive policy making experience. You know, it's not like he's, it's not like, you know, Marty or I getting a bunch of money and running for president. I mean, he's, you know, led a large city. You know, he's trying to, he's been very active politically on gun control,
right,
and other issues. So it's not like he hasn't, you know, disappeared from the political scene. So he has things to talk about, like when he comes to Akron or Chillicothe. I think he was talking about opioids down there.
I think it was interesting, his first big ad by, and correct me if I'm wrong, of course, revolved around health care, which is something that the Democrats used in 2018 to take back the House, used it very successfully, as a matter of fact, and just kept beating that drum. And he seems to have picked up on that rhythm, getting back to that issue that still remains top of mind for most Americans.
I think that's definitely true. You know, everybody either has a family member or themselves or knows somebody who has really struggled with our healthcare system. You know, it's a leading cause of bankruptcies in
the United
States.
It's the top of the front page in the Dispatch today.
There you go. And I think that this is an easy issue for the Democrats to connect with voters on, because I think in retrospect, Republicans would say they didn't do themselves any favors with their relentless opposition to Obamacare and provisions like, you know, protecting people with pre-existing conditions.
And yet, when you go here, listen to the debates, it just it seems to unravel into the Democrats battling each other over the intricacies or lack thereof of their plans.
Yeah, I think it's been interesting to watch that that question. I feel like is asked at almost every Democratic debate so far, and I don't know that it's actually moved forward or advanced or changed minds. Having watched most of the debates, it doesn't seem to me that you know, people have changed their position. The candidates have changed their positions, or that they've been able to kind of come together and say, "Yes, we all have different, you know, different ideas to get there, but this is the goal." And I think it's also been interesting to see kind of, and I think Joe Biden probably does this the most because he was in the Obama administration, but, you know, the Affordable Care Act has become a pretty popular piece of legislation. Just, you know, pulling on it, it pulls very well. People like the benefits that it has provided. And you don't really see them kind of saying, well, yes, we really, you know, recognizing that as a big a policy accomplishment and maybe building on it. I think that's, you know, Biden takes that approach, but the others have not really.
Yeah.
I think that some of the candidates may have painted themselves into a corner. You know, Medicare for all versus fixing the Affordable Care Act. Those have turned into slogans, and they've gotten portrayed a certain way. And I don't know that that serves anybody very well either. You know, probably where people are is they want more people to have health insurance. They want people to not go broke just because they get sick, that sort of thing. And I don't know. I don't know that Elizabeth Warren, for example, has helped herself by saying, "I'm for this thing that other people now are going to call socialism."
Mm-hmm. We are going to take a break. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. Lots to talk about, as usual. Still with us, Jackie Borchardt of the Cincinnati Enquirer and Marty Schladen of the Columbus Dispatch. Jeremy Pelzer of Cleveland.com is going to be joining us. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Mike Thompson.
And I'm Steve Brown, and we are the hosts of Snollygoster, WOSU's podcast all about politics in Ohio.
Each week, we chat about what the shrewd politicians at the State House are up to and how national politics affects us here at home.
Find out why listeners have called us a weekly must-listen. For a lighthearted yet in-depth look at Ohio politics, subscribe to Snollygoster wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Jackie Borchardt of the Cincinnati Inquirer, Marty Schladen of the Columbus Dispatch. Joining us is Jeremy Pelzer with Cleveland.com. Welcome to the show.
Hi, great to be here.
You were at Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost launched a human trafficking summit to build, as it said in the headline in Cleveland.com, a, quote, freedom to freedom for freeway to freedom for victims. What's this all about? What's he doing different?
Dave Yost is really, it seems he's really putting a lot of political capital in this. He has done a lot of things to fight human trafficking, which Ohio for years has been one of the worst states in terms of human trafficking. Mm-hmm. In addition to doing this summit, which really brings law enforcement and advocates and different people involved in fighting human trafficking together, he's formed a sort of task force within his office to focus on human trafficking cases. And it seems his first year, he was kind of reactive as Attorney General. He'll let things happen and then respond to them. And now this seems to be one of the issues that he's really been proactive on and is really trying to tackle.
Is he doing anything particularly differently?
Right now, he seems to be focusing on not doing anything new except for bringing more people together. Like, everyone has their own initiatives in different areas, and he's just really trying to bring together more collaboration between them. He's also the big thing, of course, is money, you know, and he's really trying to devote more money and more resources to this. And so far, you know, the Attorney General doesn't have power to, you know, that's up to the legislature to do it. But he seems to be working with the resources he's had, and he's fighting for more.
It sounds to me, too, like he's advocating more enforcement concerning prosecution, going after Johns and that sort
yes.
of thing.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, he's also fighting for tougher laws regarding going after the people who solicit sex, and also just tougher enforcement against not so much the victims of human trafficking, the women and men involved in that, but also the people who are soliciting, and also like the traffickers themselves.
The
pimps and the traffickers themselves.
Well, we'll see how that goes. Frank LaRose, the Secretary of State, has ordered boards of elections to block cyber activity from Iran. What's going on, Marty Schladen?
Well, when things started to heat up between us and Iran, after we sent a drone and assassinated Soleimani, he noticed that different boards of election systems had gotten pinged by Iranian web addresses. He didn't say there were any penetrations, but I think everybody expects that this election is going to be attacked not just by Russia. It's probably going to be Russia, Iran, China, and a number of other—
North Korea,
right.
So what can a county election official be on guard for? I mean, what can they do if it gets to that point?
Well, he activate. I don't know if "activate" is the right word. That might actually be a term of art. But he got the National Guard's volunteer cyber unit involved. Okay. I think that he's trying to have people on the local level talking to the officials at the boards of election, which all have different systems, which is thought of as a benefit because it makes it harder to hack the entire system. If you know, there are 88 different. Systems out there.
Right.
But I think what he's trying to do is have everybody at the local level being aware of this and trying to, you know, stop anything bad from happening.
He's also identifying IP addresses that are suspicious and telling local elections officials to block those IP addresses.
Okay, this is going to be an interesting election on many levels.
Yeah, it's only January, too.
It's only January. There is a debate this week, is there not?
On Wednesday.
Democratic debate, the candidates. They're still working on that. I mean, the primary season is only just getting underway now. technically.
Yeah, we haven't had one vote.
Right.
So. And especially in Ohio, where we don't vote till March, it hasn't even, I guess, really started, except for, like we said earlier, Mike Bloomberg's ads.
Yeah, the March, on St. Patrick's Day is primary day.
That's
Do you guys
correct.
Have any strong feelings about that, whether it'll make a difference, or are you going to be too busy partying?
I don't know. I mean, on a Tuesday, you know,
right. I can it's a school vote, night for me.
I can vote and then go drink green beer. But there may be some people for whom St. Patrick's Day is a big enough deal that it would alter exercising their civic duty. But I personally don't think it should.
I know last year when lawmakers had made that change, moved it from the 10th to the 17th, there was some pushback from some urban elections officials, especially in Cleveland, where they have a big St. Patrick's Day celebration, big parade downtown, that it might make it – they might have to change some polling places, and that's always a concern to change longstanding polling places. And it seems that those concerns have largely gone away, but that I know that was one of the issues that was
attracting
brought up at
poll
the time.
Workers. Any
that's always a challenge.
Yeah, exactly.
It is a primary. It would be I think obviously more difficult if it was a big general election. Of course, in Ohio, you can get an absentee ballot and vote, you know, for 30 days up. You know, roughly 30 days before the election.
Why did they switch it anyways? I can't even remember anymore.
Because the Republican National Committee they dock states that don't have their primaries or caucuses within a certain period. And so it made sense without getting into the nitty gritty of it. Uh-huh. That was the time that Ohio Republicans said, OK, we can hold this primary without being docked delegates at the National Convention.
Okay. All right. Interesting.
It's never good to you're always going to have an issue when an election falls on a major holiday but at the same time I think, you know, this is an opportunity too. You could have during the St. Patrick's Day parade, you could have some get out the vote efforts. I know our WOSU's Andy Chow coined Shamrock the Vote. You know, you could go around and actually incorporate it and actually use it and turn it from a liability into a good thing.
And in the spirit of full disclosure, it's Ohio Public Radio, State House News Bureau.
I beg your pardon.
We air Andy Chow's fine work.
Cheerfully withdrawn.
But yes. No. Yeah.
And as long as we're talking about poll workers, I just want to say, you know, every time I go to vote, I thank the poll workers for showing up. And, you know, anybody out there who might be interested in doing it, you should consider it. I mean, this is how you make democracy actually work in this
right.
country.
There is training. I'd love to be a poll worker someday.
I did it once.
Oh, okay.
When I was in high school. And if you're 17 or 18, you I think they just released something today
too,
that you
yeah.
can be a poll worker. And it was one of the longest days of my life. But
yeah.
it gave me a really, you know, a different perspective on the process and an appreciation for all the people who make that happen. It's a lot of work, and they don't really make that much money. There's certainly a...
You don't do it for the money.
No, you don't do it for the money.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That is Jackie Borchardt of the Cincinnati Enquirer. Also with us, Marty Schladen of the Dispatch and Jeremy Pelzer of Cleveland.com. Yeah, I've always been kind of critical of the fact that they moved him out of schools, polling places, because I remember growing up, and when it was election day, that was a big deal when you'd see people lining up to vote. And it was edifying to see that as a child, that people would wait in line to do something like
yeah,
that.
That's and yeah, it's kind of modeling civic behavior.
Yeah, exactly.
Agreed.
You know, who knows? I mean, there's reasons, but anyways. All right, the Ohio Republican Party leaders have declined to endorse some candidates in some races. What's going on there, Jeremy Pelzer?
Well, the Central Committee for the state met on Friday. And as normal, they endorse in primaries. And most of the endorsements were completely not controversial. Like, for example, you might be shocked to learn they endorsed Donald J. Trump for president again. But there were some notable names that were not on that endorsement list. For example, Christina Hagan, who's running against Tim Ryan, her name was not on that list, even though she's the only as far as I know, the only Republican running for that seat. And she's the most competitive primary or general election opponent that I think Tim Ryan so far has had. And so and then in addition, you have Jean Schmidt, who's another who's a former member of Congress. She's now running for state representative. And they actually not only did they not include her, it was recommended that she was endorsed, but the party committee actually took her name off the list and then endorsed her opponent instead. And so these are some notable changes. And I should say that the endorsements aren't just about just a rubber stamp and something that you can put on your flyers. Mm-hmm. If you get the endorsement of the party, you get access to their nonprofit mailing permit, which means mail is cheaper. You get access to their voter data files. So this is actually something that can matter in a primary campaign.
Who's driving this, Jeremy? Do you think it's Jane Timken? Do you think the DeWine people have any involvement in this?
Well, for Gene Schmidt and there were a few other lesser-known candidates that were also passed over, this was really a fight between Larry Householder, who favored Gene Schmidt, and some of these other candidates. The caucus he controls recommends all these people. But then there are these local county parties that totally disagree and said, we don't want Columbus telling us who to vote for. Mm-hmm. And so the state party listened to these county parties more. Like, look, we endorse someone else, or we haven't even met yet to endorse. So we're going to either ignore Householder's recommendation or actively go against it. As far as Christina Hagan goes, that's a little bit different. Christina Hagan actually texted me that she, you know, didn't even actively seek the endorsement. Well, okay. Part of it, too, is that there are some of the candidates, too, have been criticized by the party or by Jane Timken in the past, although it's unclear. That wasn't brought up on Friday, these past controversies.
Hmm. Well, what does it say about the relationship between the Ohio Republican Party then and the Speaker of the House, that they're taking the counties over him?
I don't want to overstate it. It's not like it's a huge blow to Larry Householder.
It ticked him off, though.
It's not the best for him. But at the same time, it shows that Larry Householder, while he might control the Ohio House Republicans, he certainly doesn't control the Ohio Republican Party.
Well, and I mean, the candidates, even though the candidates that were favored by Householder but not endorsed by the state party, I mean, that may actually help them in their districts. That may be seen as, you know, giving some street cred to an outsider status, for example. They still may be successful even without the party's endorsement. I mean, Gene Schmidt is a very well known name in that district. Candace Keller, George Lang primary will also be very interesting to watch there. She's done very well in that district. She's one of those candidates that where I was thinking of just a few minutes ago about, you know, she embraces kind of an outsider outside the status quo, outside the establishment lane, and that not being endorsed just kind of fuels that fire.
Maybe you should remind people why she's so far on the outside right now.
Right. Well, you know, when the Senate GOP had forwarded their endorsements and they had chose George Lang, also a state representative, over Representative Candace Keller, and, you know, we called over there, and they said the main reason for that is because it's kind of hard to endorse someone that the chairman, Jane Timken, has asked to resign. You know, after the Dayton shooting in August, Candace Keller put a Facebook post up. It was pretty inflammatory, blaming all variety of things for the shooting. Obama, liberals, marijuana.
It was sort of
unwed
shocking
mothers.
In its variety,
it was a list. And anyway, you know, party leaders had asked her to resign, and she said, no, I'm not doing that. And so it's kind of hard then for, you know, 6 months later for Jane Timken to put a stamp of approval on that.
Has Gene Schmidt ever walked back any of that?
Oh, you mean Candace Keller?
I'm sorry, Candace Keller. Sorry, excuse me.
No. I mean, she hid the post so it wasn't publicly viewable, but as far as I know, still remains on her page visible to friends and other folks.
And when we asked Jane Timken on Friday whether she still thinks Keller should resign, she kind of dodged the question. She was like, well, as you know, back then I called on her to resign, and we followed up a couple of times, and she kind of dodged the question.
You made the salient point that there are practical considerations when you talk about endorsements, particularly from the Ohio Republican Party. But do voters care much about endorsements anymore, given the fact that, well, I don't know. I mean, does it matter?
Well, another perk is that you'll probably end up on the slate card, the party slate card that's handed out. And if you're down the ballot, that is a huge help. Getting those cards out. I know the slate cards are what Ohio Democrats are crediting for getting two Supreme Court justices in. The fact that, you know, even though their party label didn't appear on the ballot, they were on the slate card that people were literally taking into the ballot box with them.
We are going to continue our conversation. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That is Jackie Borchardt of the Cincinnati Enquirer, also with us, Jeremy Pelzer of Cleveland.com, and Marty Schladen of the Columbus Dispatch. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Jackie Borchardt of the Cincinnati Enquirer, Marty Schladen of the Columbus Dispatch, and Jeremy Pelzer of Cleveland.com. Jackie, you wrote about Ohio's medical marijuana, as it said in the headline, Catch-22, that all the rules and stuff make it almost impossible for people to actually get enough of the drug that they need.
Yeah. So Ohio has set a limit of like how much marijuana you can buy in a 90-day period. And the 90-day period came from the law, but the actual amount came from the pharmacy board. It was decided later. And so a lot of patients, that sounds okay. It sounds reasonable up front. But what they found after going back to the dispensary to buy more is that they couldn't, it wasn't just the 8 ounces subtracting whatever they bought before. They also lost days where they had not purchased anything. So there is kind of a use it or lose it aspect to that 8 ounces. So if you wait until day 45 without buying anything and you go in, you cannot buy 8 ounces. You can only buy half of that. You can buy four. And then the way that they limited how much you can, the smallest amount you can buy and the units that you can buy, they made a 10th of an ounce, which is kind of a weird amount anyway. If you're a longtime marijuana consumer, things are usually measured in eighths and quarters and halves of an ounce. But they made it a 10th. And the problem is, though, that you multiply that amount by 90 days and you're over 8 ounces. So what the dispensaries have been doing on from the pharmacy board's guidance is that those containers round up. So people went in buying a small container thinking that was 1 day worth of your supply, and it actually counted as two. So if someone is on a fixed budget or they're trying to, you know, they're new to the program, they're trying to find out which product works for them because it's not an exact science right now and it's kind of trial and error, and they bought, you know, five small containers, that's actually 10, they bought 10 days worth of product. So what's happened is a lot of folks, they end up getting into a situation where they go into the dispensary and they are told they only have 4 days worth that they can buy. And that's been really frustrating, especially, like I said, for people who are on a fixed budget because, insurance doesn't pay for your medical marijuana. It's cash. And although there are discounts, it can still be pricey. And so even if maybe you saved up your money and you went in, but you can only buy 4 days and the whatever special they're running that day doesn't apply to what you can get. It's just been very frustrating. So the pharmacy board is going to make a change that sounds kind of silly at first, but it's going to make a big difference. And that's to change that smallest unit that can be bought so that it's actually 1/90th, so that if you buy 90 of the small containers, it's 90 days instead of 180 days.
Wow.
But up front, like I talked to several patients in the last few weeks since the state announced this change. And, you know, when I tell them, oh, they're going to make it instead of 2.83 grams, it's going to be 2.52. And they're like, well, that's silly. So now I'm going to, you know, pay the same amount for less weed. And then it's like, well, actually, it will help you if you're it just means that every container will add up to a proper amount of days. There's no rounding up. Where you know, penalized for not being able to buy more.
How do people, I mean, there aren't that many dispensaries.
There's 47 of the state licensed 57, and 47 have their operating certificate and are open.
But they're not equally distributed, are they?
So the state broke up, the pharmacy board broke up the state into several districts. And in large counties, like Franklin County is its own district, and we can have up to 5 in Franklin County, but the smaller counties were grouped and in groups of 2 or 3, and they share, in some instances, 3 counties share 1 dispensary.
Yeah.
And in some of these districts, they didn't award any licenses because they either didn't have anyone apply or there weren't applicants that met the minimum standards. But, you know, it's been a really slow rollout over the last year for these dispensaries. So especially in the urban areas, you know, Columbus didn't have a dispensary the first day or month that they were open. And then there was just 1 in Columbus for several months. And now we have 3. Cincinnati just got its first dispensary in city limits, opened last week. So, you know, that's almost a whole year from the first day of sale. So it's been, I think, you know, a year ago, because it's January 16th that the first sales happened last year.
Right.
So we're approaching the 1 year anniversary. And I think a lot of people saw that and said, oh, it's open. It's great. We're good. We're going. But it's been a really slow rollout. And like I said, this change on what you can buy and the limits is coming, you know, a year into the program.
Our state, the people in charge at the state level, because I know there's like 3 different agents, the pharmacy board, the Department of Commerce, and
Medical board.
But all things being equal, are they pleased with the rollout? I mean, have they valued it in any way and said what's working, what's not, and whether it's good enough?
In December they had an advisory committee meeting. It's kind of this appointed group of people that's supposed to kind of be a check on the process and weigh in, but they don't really have any power or say in what happens. And, you know, all things considered, when you look a year ago today, we've come a long way. You know, prices are down. There's more dispensaries. There's more. We didn't even have any infused products a year ago. It was just plant material, flower. And that the products didn't start coming until April and May.
Edibles, that kind of a
thing? Yeah, edibles, tinctures. Now there's some topicals, there's patches. So I think when you kind of look at those metrics, like we've come a long way. We have a lot of almost 80,000 patients that are registered. That's huge. But I think they do recognize that, you know, there's still initial licensees that are not yet operating, that they're still working with these companies to get them up and running and open. And then, of course, you have to say at one point, stop and evaluate and say, okay, do we need to grow this program more? Because if you'll remember the initial licenses that they set limits for, those can be expanded if there is demand and not enough supply to meet that demand.
This process was supposed to go online. I think the stores were first supposed to be open on September 8th of 2018. So it seems to me anyway that there have been problems throughout. I don't know. You probably have a good sense of this, Jackie, whether other states' rollouts have been as bumpy as Ohio's.
Generally, yes. I think generally it takes a couple years. Maryland took even longer. They had several court challenges there that put it off. Ohio, I believe there's still a couple, you know, court cases lingering, but they kind of, we went through what would have been the big problematic ones rather quickly. You know, 2 years sounds like it is a long time, especially to a lot of the patients that I've talked to. It's a long time, but it's still shorter than some other states. Now, Pennsylvania is a good benchmark for us because they passed their law just a few weeks before us.
Right.
But they were up and running almost a whole year before Ohio was. And the big difference there is right away they put in place some emergency rules. And in Ohio, we waited 3 months until the law took effect, and then they started working on the rules. So even though they met the kind of guidelines, it was already from the start going to be a slower process than our neighbors to the east.
There were suppositions and accusations in some quarters that Ohio was dragging its feet, that the Kasich administration specifically was dragging its feet, you know, that it was a choice they made to wait. They could have had people working.
They weren't doing anything to expedite it, I think, is probably the fairest way to say it. Kasich kind of reluctantly signed that bill because there was a ballot initiative coming,
right,
and you don't want that. He didn't have a signing ceremony like Pennsylvania and other states have had. They could have started work on that earlier.
Is there any sense that the DeWine administration is more amenable to this process, or is it too far gone and it really doesn't have a fingerprint on it, like, in that way?
I think this is one of those things that when he came into the office, they had a desire to make sure it works correctly. I spoke with she's not new now because we're in year two,
yeah.
Cheryl Maxfield, and she seemed very also eager to make sure that they get it to where it needs to be. Of course, you know, the governor, he does not support recreational marijuana,
right,
use or legalization, and he's said that recently, that he doesn't think that Ohio should legalize for wider use.
Hmm. Michigan's kicked off its legalization of recreational now, I think.
It has. And so has Illinois. And the turnout in Illinois was so heavy in the first couple of days that some dispensaries had to shut down. They ran out of product. I think that Michigan's is going more smoothly. So it's interesting that Governor DeWine is disinclined to do that here. I got to think a lot of people are just going to drive from Ohio to Michigan.
Mm-hmm. Inevitably, they already are driving to Michigan. My colleague Laura Hancock went up and interviewed a whole bunch of them Ohioans who went to Michigan. The Highway Patrol says that they're not really going to step up enforcement along the Michigan border.
Well, they can't pull you over because they suspect.
Correct. All they can do is, just if they pull you over for something else, see if you have it. It's not like there's no customs stop at the border we have to declare. My point is that if it's kind of inevitable that you're going to have people from Ohio going up to Michigan, especially when it's so easy. All you need is, hop in the car, go up to Michigan.
I wonder if now Ohio always is late to, to take on these kind of mantles anyways, but I'm wondering if it's going to go the way of legalizing gambling, that finally the state's going to look at the lost revenue from the opportunity and say, we're surrounded now.
And if and when that happens, the key will be who gets the money from that, who is in control of this new product, this new legalized product. There was, a few years ago, there was that recreational marijuana ballot issue that would have written in the Constitution, only a very small group of people could get it. And so this is, at the end of the day, about money.
Yeah. And who gets it? And who would manage it at the state? Would it be something like the liquor control? Is that what they've done in other states? Is it gone to that?
I know, like in Colorado and I think Washington, they've put them they're kind of under the same umbrella there, but they don't, I don't know that it's not like liquor control here where we have the same price, where it's an inventory and price control. It's just those are the regulators that handle it. But in those states, they haven't capped the number of licenses. It's if you submit an application, you meet the requirements, you pay the fee, you get licensed. It's more of a free market approach.
Hmm. Interesting. So I wondered what you guys are looking forward to this week. A lot of us are just waiting to see if anything happens at the federal level with the impeachment trial getting underway. That affects me. But what about you guys? What are you looking at, Jeremy Pelzer?
Well, Ben Carson's coming to Columbus tomorrow. He's going to make an announcement on homelessness. We'll see what that is.
The
Secretary of Housing and Urban Development.
Right.
Former presidential candidate.
Do you know? I mean, do we have any idea what he's going to say?
Not yet. Yeah. But it's probably, my guess is these things usually involve money and grant or funding in some sort of program.
Okay.
Something that happened Friday that I didn't get into the paper, embarrassingly, it was a really big deal. The U.S. Supreme Court decided to take a case from Arkansas that, and this is going to sound really arcane, but it's not. It will consider whether the federal ERISA law, which regulates employee benefits and pensions, can continue to be used by pharmacy benefit managers to preempt state level regulations. And like I said, this sounds really arcane, but we're talking about billions of dollars and the ability of state governments to.
We have a minute. Tell us what that has to do with. How are the pharmacy benefit managers using ERISA laws?
So they have gone in the current case. They sued the state of Arkansas over regulations that would prohibit certain pricing practices and the sorts of things that critics say is just classic rent seeking. They're in a dominant sector of the marketplace. There's no price transparency, and they're accused of using those two circumstances to profit unfairly. And when the state passed laws and the governor signed them, they went to court. And this is not the only time. There have been many times where they've gone to court and they've gotten the federal courts to agree that state governments don't have the power to regulate this space because it falls under ERISA, which is a federal law.
Okay.
And Arkansas is saying, that's BS, that this doesn't fit with ERISA. And so now it's made it all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court on Friday held a conference and decided to grant the writ of certiorari. So at some point, people are going to stand before them and make their arguments.
Okay. Jackie Borchardt, what's up?
I'm going to watch the debate, the Democratic debate, and try not to fall asleep by the end.
From stem to stern. Well, it won't be as many. What is there, five people have qualified?
Six.
Six, okay.
And that's not to gauge my interest level. I just go to bed very early.
I understand.
I have to like prepare myself with a late afternoon coffee and some snacks and make sure. I'll be interested. This is the last debate before the Iowa caucuses, which I'm watching from afar. But our sister paper, the Des Moines Register, has been covering the heck out of the caucuses.
They do a great job.
Their lead political reporter is going to be one of the moderators. And so I'll be, watching to see what kind of job she does and also to see what happens between now and the February caucus.
I should give a correction. The debate's actually tomorrow, not Wednesday.
Wednesday.
It was Wednesday. It's actually on Tuesday.
That's just
Tuesday.
When we'll read about it on Wednesday, but yes. It's actually on Tuesday. Okay. All right. Well, you guys, I want to thank you for joining us today. As always, Jeremy Pelzer, Cleveland.com politics reporter. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
And Marty Schladen, reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. As always, Marty, thank you.
Thank you, Ann.
And Jackie Borchardt, Columbus Bureau Chief for the Cincinnati Enquirer. Thanks, Jackie, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 MPR News.